Well, hey there, and welcome to Endeavors. Well, hey, and welcome to episode 6. On today's show, we hear from Artistic Director of Early Music Vancouver, Matthew White, author Christy Cherish, and musical guest Caravan Palace. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Early Music Vancouver, who recently kickstarted their brand new season with the show Handel and His Rivals, which featured Amanda Forsyth accompanied by the Pacific Baroque Orchestra, and they performed beloved Handel operas as well as arias from operas by Popora, Haas, and Veracini, who composed the Opera of Nobility and briefly put Handel out of business. He is Matthew White, and here is our conversation. Matthew White, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Early Music Vancouver is launching their 2016-2017 tonight, and you're going big. You're going Handel.
Yeah, that's right. We've got a big program that's featuring the music of Handel and a bunch of the composers who are kind of his rivals in 18th century London. So it's a program of opera arias sung by really one of the world's greatest Handelian sopranos, Amanda Forsyth from Boston.
You know, when I studied it, well, not studied, but when I sort of was more into classical music as a kid, Handel to me always seemed to be one of the big five that was talked about the most often. You know, you have Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and Handel. Among others too. But what is it about Handel for you that strikes a chord?
Oh, that's a good question, and I always think of Handel and Bach as sort of two sides of the same coin from the 18th century somehow. That Bach was a, you know, very largely a composer who wrote music for the church, like spiritual music, and music that is so well constructed and you know, contrapuntally so well constructed, it's almost scientific somehow. You know, it's absolutely bulletproof compositionally, and it's incredibly impressive and emotionally attractive at the same time. But with Handel, it's he was writing from a different perspective. He was somebody who was a businessman too. So he was somebody who was writing music that he wanted people primarily to enjoy. So it wasn't just about a testament to God or a spiritual expression of his belief or anything. It was music that he was writing for people to come and pay for. So, you know, he had a very, very successful career as a composer for the public opera in England, and that's and the oratorio. But people loved him, and it's because his music was tuneful and it was full of joy and it was direct. So I like to think of him in a little bit, sort of like an 18th century Andrew Lloyd Webber. I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I think so much of what at least modern culture thinks of, and maybe millennials think of classical music is along the lines of worship and playing to God. And is that what sets Handel apart? Is yes, there was that side, but he also made it for a secular audience, so to speak.
Yeah, well, the very large majority of the music that he wrote was operatic music for the public opera stage. So no, he was a popular composer in the 18th century, meaning that, you know, people in the street knew his music. It was not music necessarily just for the elite, and that would have bothered him, I think. I think like he was somebody who wanted to appeal to a broad audience, and yet at the same time, the music doesn't sound corporate. It still sounds profound somehow. So that's what I think is really special about him, is that it's popular music that he has designed for you to enjoy. So it's tugging at certain heartstrings and using certain melodic and harmonic devices that are familiar somehow and feel good naturally. But they don't feel cheap. It still feels somehow that his craft is true and honest and direct. It's not just about selling something. So it's I don't know. I think he does something. He rides a very, very sort of difficult line to ride, in that, you know, it can vary when you start thinking about selling, putting bums in seats, and primarily appealing to people's emotions. It can very easily turn into schlocky, crappy music, you know. And with Handel, that's not the case. When you hear a Handel opera aria sung by a real Handel star, somebody who really can sing this music properly, you walk out feeling deeply affected, you know. So you don't feel manipulated. You feel like it's a genuine artistic expression somehow. I know this is sort of a difficult thing to put into words, but yeah, it's just I've always felt that Bach, for instance, Bach appeals to many, many, many people because it's a kind of a blend of our intellectual capacity and our emotional capacity. And Handel is more on the emotional side, I would just say. It's something that's inherently dramatic. And people loved him. He was revered in London. And that's something that people forget. It's music that was written for the people, and he was well loved as a result. So, you know, when people think of classical music being all stuffy, I mean, 18th century London, the world that Handel inhabited, was, you know, full of drama and full of sex and full of perfume. You know, it was I can't imagine a less boring time to have lived in, you know. And musically, it was incredibly rich. And when people come tonight, what they're going to be amazed by, in addition to the incredibly beautiful music, they're going to be amazed by the virtuosity that Amanda demonstrates. So, you know, in the same way that when you hear a really great modern pop singer, you know, with incredible chops, that's what Amanda has too. So there's a certain amount of wow factor in it. You just think, holy cow, that sounds physiologically impossible what she's doing, and it also sounds fun, you know. She always just looks like she's having such a good time, and it's so easy for her, and that's something that this music requires too. It requires a certain virtuosity from the performers. And it was written for the greatest singers of the 18th century.
You know, you mentioned how it was so musically and culturally rich back then, and I feel like the sort of Baroque, early Romantic period might be the most musically and creatively rich time in the world's history, because it was right up there, sort of right in the same area as you know, just out of the Renaissance. Why do you think that was? Why is it that, you know, so much of the classical music that we listen to today comes from that era?
Well, I mean, we listen to a lot of, I think the most popular classical music, if we're going to call it that. I mean, you know, it's even hard to know what classical music means exactly. But I mean, I would say that most of the music that people hear at the symphony is probably, actually, most of it is 19th century music, right? And so even some 20th century music. But nowadays, I think the Baroque stuff, so meaning the stuff in the 17th and 18th centuries, is becoming more popular, partially because now it's 30 years into this whole period performance movement, and people have figured out how the music was originally conceived, right? So there's been a tremendous amount of research done into it, about what instruments specifically they were using and what the musical rhetoric and language at the time was. And so now when people hear that music, they're hearing it spoken with less of an accent, if that makes any sense. So they're hearing the music more as it was intended and in the style that it was written in. And I think as a result, the music is way more powerful, and so people are more interested in it, you know. So that's really at the core of what we do here at Early Music Vancouver, is we take music from any given musical period And we ask people to interpret it who have spent a tremendous amount of their lives figuring out how to do it in a way that was common and in usage at the time it was written. So to give you an example, for instance, tonight, everybody on stage will be playing on copies or original instruments from the 18th century. So I don't know if that's something that your listeners know, but like all of the violins on stage will be strung up with gut instead of metal strings, which you would hear at the Vancouver Symphony. And with a different angle on the soundboard, and they're using a different type of bow that's common just to the 18th century. And we're using a harpsichord instead of a piano and all those sorts of things. So by using all of that technology that was common in the 18th century, the music somehow speaks more eloquently. It speaks more powerfully. And we've seen a huge resurgence in public interest as a result, I think, because the music just comes alive, you know?
You know, I think another thing that strikes me about that time period is so much of the music and so many of the composers were from Austria, Germany, Italy, you know, that area of the world. Why is it you think there was such a heavy concentration of music output from those three countries during that time?
Oh, that's a really, really tough thing to say. I mean, I would say that there were, most of the classical music that was being written in the 17th and 16th, 17th and 18th centuries was music that was patronized by great rulers, right? By a great ruling class. So it was a time at which, you know, if you were somebody who was a powerful person, or you were a powerful country, or that what you would do is to show off how powerful you were and how influential you were, you would show how cultured you were. So it was a reflection of culture, was a reflection of power. You see what I mean? And that has changed a lot now. Money seems to speak for itself now, and that's all you need to demonstrate is that you've got money and military. But at the time, if you had huge amounts of money and military strength, that was reflected in how you would hold court, right? So diplomatically, it was the music served as sort of a cultural ambassadorship role. And the greater the country, the greater the music that it produced. And so I think that's a big part of why we still go back to so much of the music that was written at that time, because the music was it was well funded, it was well supported, and subsequently a lot of people did a lot of creative, amazing things, you know? I wish it was the same way today, you know, in a way that, I mean, I know in Canada we're better off than in the States, for instance, where in the States now the government doesn't support the arts at all, essentially. But in the 18th century, the government was the main supporter of the arts. So that's a really key difference, I would say.
Let's talk about Amanda for a minute, because this is her third performance with you guys. And I know her first actually garnered her a Juno Award. What was that like for you guys, knowing that you helped bring that about for her?
Well, that's not quite correct. My memory is that she performed on our CD of Handel's Orlando, which was Juno nominated.
Oh, okay.
But she has won a Grammy Award with the Boston Early Music Festival, so that's exciting. I mean, she's somebody that I met for the first time on stage when I was a singer. I remember being in a rehearsal, and you know, after she finished her aria, when I was on stage with her, I remember just thinking, "How on earth do I follow that?" You know, she's just unbelievably talented. So, you know, the fact that she's willing to come back and work with us is a testament to, I think, to the relationship between her and Alex Vyman, who's our the Pacific Baroque Orchestra's musical director. And, you know, I'm just really happy that she keeps, that she's willing to come back there, even as her fame increases, because she's getting harder and harder to pin down, obviously. But, you know, every time she comes, people have exactly the same reaction, which is, oh, wow, we're in the presence of somebody who's a bona fide star, you know, somebody who's in the same way that Joyce DiDonato or, David Daniels or some of these big operatic stars. She's got very similar chops and appeal to these people.
You mentioned early on that she's a Handelian soprano, and I'm curious as to what makes a opera singer or a star a specialist in Handel. What are some unique qualities of a Handel aria?
Well, the thing about Handel, and if you listen to any of his operas, Julius Caesar, or Orlando, or any of these major Italian operas that he wrote in London, all of the main characters have to do a number of things, but the two main things that they have to be able to do vocally is they have to be able to sing long, slow, languid arias, and they also have to be able to sing what they call bravura arias, which means arias that demonstrate their technical virtuosity, their ability to sing fast and high, and also to improvise and to add ornaments. And so that's something that there are many beautiful voices out there who can do one of those two things. And for instance, I, as a singer, I had a great career singing mostly the sad language stuff. And so I was never going to be a big star in the way that Amanda is or, some other people are, in that I could not sing fast enough to sing the bravura arias. And what Amanda has is she has the capacity really to sing long, beautiful legato lines, but then also to sing incredibly fast and with the type of virtuosity that just makes the audience astonished, and often they'll giggle. You'll actually see them laughing in the audience because they just can't believe what they're seeing, in the same way that you might be amazed at a high wire act or something.
I feel like Handel might be, or Handel is the composer of perhaps the most famous classical piece of music of all time. I'm talking about Hallelujah, of course. Everyone knows it. It's instantly recognizable. What is it? Why is that particular piece or that particular section of music so famous?
Well, I'll start by saying it's part of a really, really, it's part of one of the most successful classical music pieces of all time, the Messiah, right? So I would start by saying that the Hallelujah chorus is famous in part because it's sort of the most joyous D major moment of the most famous piece of all time. So I think that's the short answer. When you do the whole Messiah in its entirety, and especially if you do it with really wonderful forces, that moment is always an incredible release for everybody in the audience and everybody on stage. So I think that's the short answer. It's just because it's the apex of maybe the most successful oratorio ever written. And I think it's singable as well by amateur choirs and professional choirs, which is another thing that's nice about it. So it's not something that you just have to listen to and be excluded from, as it were, as a music lover. If you want to, you can sing along. And so there's that, and there's also the fact that it's that famous story of the king standing up and being so impressed by it that he stood up, and that whole tradition began. That whenever anybody subsequently heard the Alleluia chorus, they would stand up as a sign of respect for the king who did it for the first time. And so there's just that sort of legend and theater around the piece too. Yeah.
Early Music Vancouver's 2016-27 season launches tonight with Handel and his rivals. Matthew White, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
All righty, have a good one. Best of luck tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Bye.
All righty, cheers.
That was my conversation with Early Music Vancouver's artistic director, Matthew White. Now, here is a song by Caravan Palace off their new album, Robot Face. This is Comics.
Oh,
That was Comics by the French electro swing band Caravan Palace. Recently, I had a chance to speak with one member of that fabulous sextet, Hugo Payen, who talked to me about the group's most latest output, Robot Face. Here is our conversation. Hugo Payen, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The new album is Robot Face. I had a chance to listen to a couple of the tracks. How did this project come together for you guys as a group?
It was a long time ago. It was in 2005. We were musicians, gypsy jazz musicians. We played together with Arno and Charles in a gypsy jazz band in Paris, in cafes and weddings. And we were also electronic music producers. And we were commissioned to do a soundtrack for porn films of the 20s. So we tried something with the tools we had at that moment. And the song, it was never released anywhere, but we made it listen to our friends, and they liked it, and they encouraged us to keep on doing that, and so Caravan Palace was almost born.
They're definitely, France in particular, to me, seems to have a very strong, you know, like electric, sort of like electric swing, electric house sort of music. How big is that type of music over there, would you say?
In France?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult to answer because we have Django Reinhardt, which is very important in France and in the swing style in general. So we are quite proud of him, and it's the main swing French people listen to. And at the same time, we have new artists who play swing, but it's never the swing you can listen to in America or in North America. It's
really the Django Reinhardt style swing. So when we decided to play swing in the global sense of swing, some people were wondering what we were doing exactly, because the only markers they had was Django Reinhardt.
Speaking of Django Reinhardt, he's a big name both in Europe and here in North America. How did he inspire you guys as a group?
He was the biggest influence, maybe, because we learned every code of swing music. We didn't play jazz before we decided to play Gypsy Jazz. So with Django Reinhardt, we learned every single code of that genre and the technique too, because we learned how to play swing with Django by replaying the choruses. For me, I'm the violinist, so it was properly the choruses, solos. So we learned everything with him. Then we learned other things with Lionel Hampton, for example, or Duke Ellington. But at that moment, it was the only swing we really knew and wanted to play. So it's very, very important for us.
So I read that your first single off the new album is called Comics. What can you tell us about that track?
It's strange because a lot of people told us that 2 seconds, please. I'm sorry. I have to interrupt. 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, d'accord. Okay, super. Yes, sorry. What was the question?
Comics. Yeah, just
comics. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about comics. Yeah.
Yeah, comics is weird because when we released the tracks, the album was not released yet, and a lot of people asked us what was that track, because they couldn't hear the swing in it. But there is a lot of swing in it, and when we play it live, you have the guitar playing the typical gypsy jazz rhythmic, and there's a lot of samples everywhere of swing. But it's maybe the most most evaluated electro swing track we ever made, I think.
The other track that I had a chance to listen to that I really enjoyed was Lone Digger. What can you tell us about that? I can definitely hear swing in there.
Yeah, it's the basis of the song is a swing sample, and it's the ground of the track, and it can remind the listener to what we already did, but I think it's in a way like Comics, it's a more evaluated track than what we ever did before in the dance floor style, the high tempo style, and there's always swing in it, of course. It's the basis we try to keep.
You know, how do you find your music plays to a North American audience compared to, say, to a French or a British crowd?
It's weird because when we play in Europe, everybody knows about electro swing and is aware of what it is, the phenomenon it is, and all the artists. When we play here in North America, a lot of people discover our music. They come, they don't really know why they come to the concert, but they are here, and so we can. All time we come here, we see the same sparkling eyes, the same enthusiasm from the public, and that's something which is a bit lost in Europe sometimes. So now we are quite convinced that our best public is here, because the audience are always hysterical, and there's always an incredible mood in the room, in the venue.
Do you think I don't know, to me it seems like there's a bit of
it seems there's been a bit of revival of sort of jazz and swing type music. Why do you think those genres are having their moment right now?
It never has disappeared, I think, but it has been associated with joy, with naive moments, maybe a sort of freedom in everything. The women becoming like men and a lot of things like that. So it has a very good image. So it never really disappeared, but. In times of crisis, I think of Europe because in Europe, I think it's one of the main reasons why it works. There's a big crisis, and in time of crisis, I think that people need that kind of music, and they need to go in a venue to see a concert and just forget about everything about their all day life for an hour and a half. That's all they want, and I think that swing music and what it represents is a good way for that.
On that note, how do you think music can heal us or you know, at least soothe us through difficult times?
I told you it's a way to forget some things for a moment, and it's, I don't know, if the artist is good enough, he can take you to a journey where you couldn't even imagine you could go, and when you come back to Earth, you're like, wow, what happened? That was so cool. And for an hour or two or three, maybe, or a whole night, you will just think about it and not about other problems or things you don't want to think about.
Well, the album is Robot Face. It is out now. Hugo Payen, Caravan Palace, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for calling me.
Alrighty, au revoir, bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was my conversation with Hugo Payen, of the French electro swing group Caravan Palace. And now another song from their album Robot Face. This is Aftermath. Thank you. That was the song Aftermath by Caravan Palace off their album Robot Face. My final guest is an author whose debut novel is interesting. It's about a young woman named Kincaid Strange. She's 27, lives in rain-soaked Seattle. And because in Seattle, raising zombies are outlawed, she had to take out a living by running seances for university students desperate for guitar lessons with the ghost of a grunge rocker, who happens to be Kincaid's roommate. It's this and more that make up the strange tale of voodoo killings. She is Christy Cherish. Here was our chat. Christy Cherish, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. So you've got a new book out, The Voodoo Killings. Zombies and zombie fiction have been around for years. What attracted you to that literary genre?
I didn't quite set out to write a zombie novel. It just sort of happened. The thing that sort of drew me to urban fantasy was it's got sort of a mystery twist to it. So it's, you often see sort of your old sort of noir style mystery novels mixed in with paranormal stuff. And everybody was doing zombies. Everybody was doing virus zombies and post-apocalyptic type stuff. And I decided, I decided, well, I'm going to toss some zombies in here, but I want them to be voodoo zombies. I don't want them to be the virus ones. Everybody's doing that, so I want it to be a little more original.
And, you know, reading your thing here, it says it's going to be part of a series. Did you know right away that it was going to be sort of the first in a number of books?
So when I started out writing it, no. You never, when you sort of sit down and write something, at least for me, I never really know quite whether it's going to be a standalone or what I'm going to end up writing. But once I got to, once I sort of got about halfway through, I was like, okay, I can probably turn this into some kind of series. And it's fun to think about how you can continue the character on and sort of continue the story on. So by the end of it, I was like, okay, I think I could do some more books in here. And I have this thing where I like doing almost like a cliffhanger. So after I finish the novel, I kind of like writing in, give a bit of a tease of what might happen in the next book. So yeah, maybe halfway through.
And so you're talking about voodoo and that you set it in sort of modern day suburban Seattle. That choice, sort of setting it in a modern US.
Yeah, so there's actually two sides to that reason. And one of them that I guess the more artistic side of it is I didn't grow up entirely on the West Coast. I moved out from Toronto when I was in high school. So right in the 90s, when that sort of grunge music scene was happening on the West Coast. And I got out here and I really loved living in the West Coast. I loved the vibe that was out here. And I also really liked the history. There's this really cool sort of seedy Wild West history that's kind of, it sort of pervades its way all the way up the coast, everywhere from, all the way from San Francisco up to Alaska. And I wanted to include that in the novels. You always see, New Orleans and, sort of that cool kind of voodoo vibe coming out of New Orleans, or paranormal vibe in a lot of urban fantasy novels. And you don't see a lot from the West, from the West Coast. So that was the primary reason why I didn't put it in Vancouver versus Seattle. That's a little more mercenary. And So one of the things that you kind of always have to think about when you're writing up a novel is who's going to buy it. Once you sort of get to that point where you're getting published, Canada actually has a very good sort of publishing presence. But for urban fantasy and the genre I was writing in, the major market is the U.S. So all the editors who are buying it are in the U.S. And I ended up going with Seattle, partly because of the West Coast. It was on the West Coast. It had the underground city. But I didn't want to alienate American editors. It ended up not being so much of an issue because a Canadian publisher picked up the novel. So yeah, but there were two sides of that.
You mentioned grunge there, and I got to ask about allegedly the ghost of Kurt Cobain. In the novel, of course, you think of Seattle grunge, you think of Kurt Cobain, but where did that plot device originate for you?
It's kind of funny. Everybody's sort of saying, oh yeah, it's sort of a pseudo Kurt Cobain. So I actually wasn't trying to do Kurt Cobain. It was more of, I think the illusion happens because he's such a figure of, at this point, he's kind of a mythic figure of that era. The whole idea of putting a ghost, having a ghost in the novel, so Nathan Cade is Kincaid Strange's roommate. And one of the things that I wanted to do was have a bit of comedic relief in the novel. And, sometimes you'll see people put in, or I wanted to have her have a bit of a foil. And, I started writing and it's like, okay, well, what kind of a character could I have? And I'm like, well, she's raising zombies. And, if you've got zombies, there's a good chance you're going to have ghosts. Those sort of ruminations is where it sort of started. And then I came up with, I'm like, what's something that really sort of symbolizes that, that era? And so I came up with Nathan. And one of the things that, I wanted to come across, I guess, with Nathan in the novel is he's very much a, whereas Kincaid has to worry about everything from rent to where she's going to work next to, what's going on with the police. And sort of the paranormal community, Nathan is just kind of himself. He doesn't have any real attachments to the world. He's very much an in the moment character. And I think, having grown up in that sort of scene in during the grunge scene, that was something that kind of, I think defined it a bit. It was very much, it was kind of the anti glam rock, or very manufactured kind of music scene. It was much more of I don't want to say sincerity to it, because I think everything, I think any kind of artistic endeavor has some kind of a sincerity to it. But there was a less refined component to it, and that's kind of what I guess I wanted to come across to Nate. Long answer, but.
You mentioned Underground City there, which is the paranormal hub in Seattle. How much sort of research did you have to do in that area and in the whole paranormal realm in general when writing this?
With regards to the Underground City, the nice thing about Seattle and Portland is there's a fair bit known about what was going on in those underground cities during sort of the late 1800s, early 1900s. So I did do quite a bit of research, but there was a lot there, which ended up which was fun to use in the novel. For example, one of the things that that pops up. A number of the characters, sort of the ones, not the main characters, but characters I mentioned in the novel, like Madame Lou, were actually real people who were there during the 1800s and, you know, was running a, you know, quote unquote seamstress shop in Seattle. But yeah, like, I mean, there were some great details that ended up coming out. Like one of the characters, one of sort of the characters in the book, one of the ghosts, you sort of find out that she used to lure people. She used to drug people when they came into one of the bars, and then after they were unconscious, would drive them to the docks and tie them to the docks, and then wait till the tide came in. And the reason, and that actually did happen. People used to do that in sort of 1800s Seattle, or sorry, 1890s Seattle, because there was a the medical school or the medical school would pay people $10 for a body, and they had to change that rule really quickly because, of course, they were coming in with gunshot wounds and, you know, knife wounds and just about anything else that, you know, you could think of to various types of strangulation marks. So that was something where they ended up figuring out that they could drown people because there were no marks. So there were some really cool details, and it was fun to research. As far as the paranormal goes, the cool thing about anything fantastical like that is it's not real, and there is a fantastical element about it. So you can kind of make up your own rules. So whereas I certainly did some research on, and sat in on some lectures on sort of cultural voodoo and such. That one, there was a lot more creation in it, and figuring out what kind of rules I wanted to use for the novel.
And voodoo. I mean, voodoo is a super old religion from Haiti, as most people know. What was your research into that like? How much of it did you adhere to, and how much of it did you make up in the novel?
I wanted to, when I was writing it, I wanted to sort of stay away from cultural, cultural appropriation. And so what I tried to do is, with the research aspect, I tried to pick up, or I tried to sort of tune into some of the more core components of voodoo, so as opposed to the actual religious aspects to it, or sort of, you know, the more historical aspects to it. So I have to say I made a lot of it. I make the aspects of it up. With the voodoo, it's more an idea of tapping into the life energy, or in this case, sort of the life or energy of the energy of the living or the energy of the dead, versus trying to alter it or do, you know, I think there's this idea of using I think there's this component where people think of voodoo such as, you know, curses and things like that. And I tried to really stay away from that because pretty well everything I read, that's more of less to do with it than the actual practices themselves. It's less about curses and things like that I guess maybe pop into movies and TV. So I just tried to stay with the sort of manipulation of energy, or in this case in the book we call it other side. It's called other side. But as far as how it's used in the book, because she uses it to sort of contact ghosts and tap into sort of another world. That's something that I that's something I created, and it was more of a way to access it in the book.
Did you ever attend a séance as part of your research or initiation into this world?
No, I didn't. And, you know, although that's a great idea. If I ever end up in New Orleans, that might be something I have to try. No, I stuck with more of the academic. I definitely stuck with more of sort of the academic lectures, and I just sort of sat in on a couple of sort of audio lectures. But that's not a bad idea.
Along that line, and academically speaking, how does one kill a zombie?
Or what kind of zombie are we talking about? Are we talking about Walking Dead zombie, or are we talking about a zombie in one of these, a zombie in the Kincaid Strange books?
Yeah, so like the zombies in your book, for example, how would you go about killing them?
How do you kill them? Well, in this particular way, the zombies are, the way that they're sort of, I guess, animated is through the, is through sort of bindings of Other Side, which is sort of this energy of the living, energy of the dead that's in the book. And so the easiest way to stop a zombie is if you are a practitioner in this world. So if you're somebody like Kincaid, you basically try and untie all of their bindings so that they fall down like a ragdoll. The other great way to do it, though, is a zombie does need a head and does need a heart in order to keep their body going. So those are two other, a little more gruesome, but that would be another way to get to permanently kill a zombie.
You mentioned The Walking Dead there earlier. I'm curious as to what your favorite zombie and sort of paranormal aspects of literature are. Like, are you a fan of The Walking Dead or some other zombie fiction that you enjoy?
I'm trying to think about that. I kind of like The Walking Dead's cool. But The Walking Dead and that sort of genre of zombie stuff, it's more about the people who are still alive versus the zombies, and that makes it interesting. But as far as actual zombies are concerned, I kind of like the idea of the ones that are in, for example, iZombie, where they're kind of thinking and they're kind of talking, and they do have to eat brains, and they are, you know, infected with something, but I think those ones are quite interesting, just because they're to me, they're more of a character.
Well, the book is The Voodoo Killings, a Kincaid Strange novel, which was just released last week on Tuesday. Christy Cherish, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
All righty, cheers.
Cheers.
That was Christy Cherish, author of The Voodoo Killings, a Kincaid Strange novel. That about does it this week. Stay tuned for my show on Monday, when my guests will be the great Sharon and Bram, formerly of Sharon, Lois, and Bram, as well as essayist and author Anne Giardini, and the music of Royal Wood. We're going to take you out with one final song from Carib Van Palace. This is Wonderland, excuse me. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Just imagine a trip to a wonderful land, a candy and jam. And I scream.
I got a hit that string, you better watch it. With a cat that I pack with a full clip. I got the whip, got the bitch that I keep undercover. All up in the cup, just to live it up. See this dope cold face, try to knock it. I keep it tight, never walk, I'm a rocket. I got a beat in it, I got a frith in it. See the big gold chain that I'm rocking. I got the ring full of bling, never dropping. I got a stash for the cash that I owe to my brother. All up in the cup, just to live it up. Look how the streets turn cold when I walk it. I'm living in the gutter, living in the gutter, 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 gutter.
Thank you.